Hi there, this is Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and you're listening to Nate on the Vinyl Guide.
This episode is brought to you by Vintage Media Grading at vmgvinyl.com. Explore how professional grading can protect your records at vmgvinyl.com.
And now, on with the show.
Oh my goodness, welcome to episode 413 of the Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. And this week, we are speaking with Mike Love of the Beach Boys. We talk about collectible records of the band, the first Surfin' and Luau single on Candix Records, recording Surfin' Safari All Summer Long, Pet Sounds, the friendly rivalry between the Beach Boys and the Beatles, the master tapes, the archive, as well as the recent announcement of the Beach Boys performing at Stagecoach 2024. All these topics and more in today's interview with a man who's seen it all and is still living it. Oh, and by the way, there is an extended version of this interview only available to show patrons at patreon.com/vinylguide. Go there now, help support our show. We always put extra stuff up there. Interviews there are commercial free, high resolution, and quite often extended just like today. More questions, more discussion with Mike Love, and those extras are only available at patreon.com/vinylguide. That support means a whole lot to us, so please go there now and enjoy all the extras as our special thank you for helping keep this show going. Oh, and finally, if you're new to the Vinyl Guide podcast, welcome to the show. Please follow the podcast in your podcast app as there are hundreds of other interviews that you could dial up anytime. Episodes and interviews such as number 400 with comedian, actor, and podcast pioneer Marc Maron. That's episode 400 of the Vinyl Guide. We celebrate Led Zeppelin with Jason Bonham, episode 383. Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters, episode 382. Kenny Jones of The Who, The Faces, and The Small Faces, episode 339. Everyone's favorite stoner, Tommy Chong, episode 320. And literally hundreds more. Follow the Vinyl Guide in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. And with that, let's get into our conversation with Mr. Mike Love on the records and recordings of the Beach Boys.
Oh, hi.
Hey, Mr. Mike Love. How are you?
Yes, that's correct. I'm okay. And you?
I'm doing wonderful, mate.
I can see you wearing a Steely Dan shirt.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't have a Beach Boys thing? Should I send you something?
Hey, well, you know, it is almost summer here. I'm down under.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I know. Wow. I don't sound like an Australian.
That's very cool.
Yeah. A lot of great beaches here. So, yeah, hope to see you guys down here at some point.
Wouldn't it be nice?
When will you come here? Well, God only knows.
Yeah. So, well, so, don't worry, baby. We'll do it again.
So, Mike, pleasure to have you on the show. And I understand there's a big announcement that's just recently happened. The Beach Boys at Stagecoach, April 2024. That's pretty exciting, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, it resonates on a whole different level than the average shows. It's kind of a special occasion for us, and we're looking forward to it.
And I guess Stamos will probably make this gig, I imagine, yeah?
I don't think we could keep him away.
Despite your best efforts.
Yeah. And if Mark McGrath's not making money somewhere, he might join us too.
Oh, phenomenal. All right. So people can get the details and tickets and make plans. Stagecoachfestival.com. That's April 26th through 28th, 2024. We can talk a little bit more about that, but Mike, this podcast deals a lot with record collectors and music memorabilia. And my question to you, are you a bit of a record collector? Have you kept things, test pressings, vinyl memorabilia over the years?
You know, I have every record ever done by the Four Freshmen. I have, you know, George Harrison's compilations. You know, I have some things, but it's my daughter Amba who collects the LPs. And, you know, she's really into that. Big time. And we like the sound of those LPs a lot better than, you know, just on your phone.
Yeah. So you do get to spend time listening to records these days, yeah?
Well, I don't. I spend a lot of time on the road recreating those records in concerts, you know, all over the place. Unfortunately, not in Australia for the last few years, but all, you know, all over the world. Our music has gone all the world. A real estate agent in New Jersey told me that he's from Iran, and they played our LPs in the summer at some place they went to in the summer in Iran. So we've had, you know, people listening to our stuff from, you know, all over the world, and which is fantastic. I do a lot of concerts, maybe as many as 150 a year. And that keeps me pretty well occupied. But when I'm home, we have our little record player, as well as our, you know, we often listen to Sirius to see if the 60s show is going to play some of our records, you know. But yeah, we very much love the LP side of things. It's nothing beats the sound quality of a nice LP.
I absolutely agree with that. So I'm going to go through some of the Beach Boys records, some of the collectible ones. And I recognize when people come on the show, sometimes they have, you know, very vivid memories. Sometimes they forgot they even exist. So feel free to hold up the yellow card or red card as they would in soccer if you get in trouble, and it's fine. So the first single from the Beach Boys, Surfin' and Luau, the labels on those were Candix Records and X Records. Do you recall much about these singles? Which came first, Candix or X?
Candix is the one I'm familiar with. It was that label was run by a gentleman who his distribution was run out of the back of his car, you know, and he actually declared bankruptcy so he wouldn't have to pay us any royalties. It was pretty interesting, but it did get the attention of Capitol Records, where we went on to do many single records, you know, Surf and Safari, the backside being 409. That was a 45. But back to Surfin', that was a 45. Surfin' is a song I came up with, and Brian and I worked it out, and Cousin Carl played the guitar, Alan Jardine played the stand-up bass, and Brian just hit us with the drumstick, you know. and that was it. It was very simple, very low budget, very primitive, but it was a catchy enough tune to get on the radio and in a few places, and it really did really well. And it's just few, but not national distribution. That came with Capitol Records,
right?
Who had a field promotion staff and all that. So that was, you know, Surfing Safari, Surfing USA, I Get Around, Help Me Rhonda, California Girls, Be True to Your School, you know, obviously Good Vibrations and all that. And Do It Again was number one in England. Mm-hmm. All those were, you know, single records and were on LPs as well, those songs.
So just finishing up with Candix, do you remember the moment you got the records in box? That's your first time on a record. How did that feel to the young Mike Love and band?
We were delirious. Yeah. We were so happy and so excited. And we heard the song on radio, you know, and so, you know, there was a contest on the local radio station in LA where they said they would play about four newly released songs, and the one that got the most call-ins, requests, would be played the following week as the record that won that contest. Well, we have so many family members, cousins, and, you know, aunts and uncles and everything, that the entire family was alerted, and we easily won that contest. And so that was our that was the first experience at record promotion, first experience of hearing our song on the radio. But it got the attention of Capitol Records, which is great. We signed with them in 1962. The Kendix label of Surfin' came out in the fall of 61. And I think it went to number two in L.A., and it might have done a pretty good-sized hit in Minnesota, of all places, and a few other places. But it wasn't a national hit like Surfin' Safari was. And then the backside of that was 409, our car song, and then Surfin' USA and Shut Down and, you know, In My Room and Be True to Your School and so on and so forth. Just one hit out, one double-sided hit after another.
What strikes me as interesting, especially with the Surfin' Safari album, you were on Capitol. I believe you were probably 20 years of age. Most of the band was younger. I think Carl was probably
21. I was the only one that could legally sign because you had to be 21 years old. I just turned 21 in March of 62. And the other guys were younger. You're right. Charles, maybe about 14.
But already the band seemed to have a natural rhythm in the studio, an understanding of the studio. And there was already experimentation. And it seems like there was a level of confidence, at least from an outsider, from what I've read, there seems to be a level of confidence for such a young group of guys going into recording in this probably foreign kind of environment of a recording studio. How do you remember recording that first album?
Well, it was at Capitol Records. They had signed us and they had us use their studio. They assigned us a producer. His name was Nick Vinay to oversee the production, but we didn't need his help because Brian and I knew what we wanted to sound like. He was extremely capable of working with other musicians. He had his main axe was the piano. And so he had the greatest rhythm. And then Carl had the guitar. So he had the keyboard and the guitar. And then there's the bass. There's a rhythm guitar was played by David Marks. And also Al Jardine, but Al left the group when we signed with Capitol Records. He didn't sign with us. It was David Marks, Brian Dennis, and Carl Wilson, and myself. But David and Carl were playing the guitars, and Brian quickly adapted to the studio, and eventually studio musicians, such as the Wrecking Crew, they're notorious, Hal Blaine and Carol Kay on the bass, and Glenn Campbell played with us on many, many, many of our earlier songs. And he actually took Brian's place on tour late 1964 when Brian was having problems on tour. I mean, he wasn't feeling well at all and didn't want to be traveling. He wanted to concentrate on music. So he left the touring group and Glenn Campbell came in for a few months before Bruce Johnston joined us. And he learned to play Bruce is a keyboard player, but he learned to play the bass in order to play with us. So that Glenn played bass, although he's a genius guitar player, he played bass with us.
Do you remember when the Beach Boys started thinking less in terms of singles and more in terms of albums?
We always thought in terms of albums. Most people did a single record, and if it made a hit, they'd run in the studio in two or three days, or maybe one day, they'd cut a whole bunch of songs and put that out as an album. We took a little more concern about it. I wouldn't say the earlier albums were so well thought out, but certainly culminated in, for instance, Pet Sounds. And the production quality of Pet Sounds far outpaced and so many other albums of its time, and it's still somewhat avant-garde, but we always did take more care in the albums and the content of the albums. I mean, it's so that the songs were, we really spent some time, Brian and I, writing these songs, or maybe it was a cover. So we've always try to keep our mind, keep the album's themes, you know, or if they weren't themes, just the collection of records that were pretty decent, yeah. Except for silliness, like we did Bull Session with the Big Daddy, and you know, on the Beach Boys Party album in 65, we did a bunch of other people's songs, covers and stuff, and Barbara Ann was chosen off that. That went to it went really big hit for us in early 66, and then the middle of 66 was Pet Sounds release, and then late in 66 Good Vibrations went to number one. And on the strength of Good Vibrations, we were voted the number one group in Great Britain, number two being the Beatles. So that was a remarkable achievement. And it's just, you know, incredible. So, you know, the Party album was a theme album. And so was Pet Sounds, for sure. But a whole different type of production.
Yeah. Well, as I understand, All Summer Long is considered one of, if not the first concept album, an artistically unified collection of songs having similar themes. I mean, I'm assuming you would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, in the same headspace and very similar topics and almost a story.
Yeah, We started thinking in those terms, trying to be a little more cohesive, even though the tempos might vary and the subject matter might vary. Quality of the production really grew and grew in a very short order throughout the years, mm-hmm. early years.
Talk to me a little bit about the quote unquote rivalry between Beach Boys and Beatles. I mean, you're both on the same U.S. label, Capitol. I'm assuming that yep. was more of a benefit than a hindrance. But as the Beach Boys and Beatles kind of continued to grow creatively, inspiring one another, what was the relationship like between the bands?
We'll be back after these messages.
There's no doubt about it. Record collecting has become a serious hobby and even an investment for many around the world. So record collectors have to ask themselves how best to protect their prized records and confidently buy and sell with others. There is an option to consider. Vintage media grading at vmgvinyl.com. vmgvinyl.com will professionally grade your record and encase it in protective plastic, so your record will retain its value for decades to come. This is the same approach that comic book and sports card collectors have done for years. Now, I know many record collectors will be horrified with the thought of having their records graded and encased in plastic. And for the majority of records, this isn't necessary. But if you have top dollar records that you need to protect, maybe a super rare album that's languishing on the shelf, a one-off misprint, or a special LP that you want to protect, look up vmgvinyl.com, Vintage Media Grading, and see if this service is right for you. That's Vintage Media Grading, vmgvinyl.com.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That's Seems Easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Talk to me a little bit about the quote-unquote rivalry between Beach Boys and Beatles. I mean, you're both on the same U.S. label, Capitol.
I'm assuming that that was more of a benefit than a hindrance. But as the Beach Boys and Beatles kind of continued to grow creatively, inspiring one another, what was the relationship like between the bands?
Well, really good. I mean, first of all, when they played in Portland at Kissin' Radio there back in the day, the big, strong top 40 in Portland. We flew up to see them perform. And it was pretty funny. Backstage, we would talk about my cousin Carl had an Aston Martin DB5, which, of course, was in the James Bond movies. I had a 48 MG, a 39 Rolls Royce, a 65 Jaguar sedan, and a convertible XKE. And they were pretty much all yellow. So I was an Anglophile in terms of cars. And George liked to race cars. And we started to be talking about cars and girls. And then John Lennon's voice was kind of raggedy. So he said, "Hey, when we get to the certain part of the song, shake your heads, the girls will scream, and nobody will care." So it was really nice. We got to meet him on that level. And then Bruce and I flew up to Chicago and met him in their suite. And we played him the beginnings of, you know, the intro of Good Vibrations and stuff. That's before long before it came out. But they were playing in Chicago, and we flew up from I think Springfield, Illinois, and you know, just and visited with the guys for a while. And then we were invited to a fancy dress party, which is a costume party in London. We were invited by the Beatles to go to that. And that's when John Lennon was dancing with his father, and who he hadn't seen in many a year. And all the guys were dressed up in their Sergeant Pepper's uniform. So that was pretty brilliant. I went as a great white hunter with the pith helmet and khaki outfit, you know. So we just had a really nice relationship and a fun relationship. But Paul came to our Vegetables recording session on the Smile album project. And he was, you know, lending his hand to that. And I was in India with Maharishi, and the Beatles were all there. When I got there, I didn't know it beforehand, but they were all there. And so Paul McCartney came down to the breakfast table playing back in the USSR before he had the bridge. And I said, "Yeah, you got to talk about the girls around Russia, and George is on my mind," and that kind of thing. So I gave him a couple of ideas for the middle piece. And sure enough, it's kind of like back in the USSR, it was kind of like a Beach Boys archetype type of song. And, you know, it went on from there, you know, by that time in India it was 1968. So it had Good Vibrations, and that had gone to number one. And so we both respected each other and dug each other's creative efforts. Mm-hmm. And so it was pretty darn nice.
As I understand, Pet Sounds was inspired in large part by Rubber Soul, and then Sergeant Pepper was inspired in large part by Pet Sounds. So as the albums kept coming, as the records were being released, there was friendly communication. I assume it's friendly communication. I guess a mutual respect. Like when you heard Sergeant Pepper, was it then a bit of a friendly challenge to then get involved in doing a next level project after that?
I think that was part of what was going on, but also both groups were very independent of each other. It just happened to be that we were on the radio at the same time. And so there was a rivalry, but Paul McCartney said that God Only Knows was his favorite record at one time. So the famous song is what he said at one time, which is pretty tremendous accolade, you know. It's, and so I, because of the White Album and hearing back in the USSR, and Dear Prudence there in India for the first time, I mean, that was a gift. It was fantastic, you know. And sometimes I would even play Back in the USSR live, you know, which is a lot of fun. I love doing the song. you know, and I loved Imagine. You know, we all loved their records. You know, here I did a cover, a version of that. You know, and so it's just been a mutual admiration, you know, kind of thing.
Right. Now, vocal harmonies are such an inextricable part of the Beach Boys' success. When the band recorded them, how much of the harmonies was pre-written and how much was worked out in the studio?
Well, it depends. If Brian and I wrote a song and we brought in the other guys and he would dish out the harmony parts to them, I would sing a bass. He would sing the high part. I might sing the lead on several of the songs, but the backgrounds, sometimes we did it in the studio, as you know, we record the track and then I'd sing a lead and then we do the harmonies around it, or we might work out the harmonies at the house, either Brian Wilson's house or back in Hawthorne in the early days, or you know, could be at my house. I remember one time I got Brian out of bed and we drove down to the beach and I, you know, walked him along the sand and we went back and created the song Do It Again, which went to number one in England, but it didn't do as well in the United States because we were leaving the record company there, I think. I think that was why. But anyway, it did well enough and it's a great song and it's reminiscent of, you know, it's automatic when I talk with old friends, the conversation turns to girls we knew when their hair was soft and long and the beach was the place to go. So I came up with the lyrics and the concept. He pounded away at the piano. We recorded that a short while later and Do It Again. So that's how that was born. So it was, you know, sometimes if it was a cover, Brian went in the studio. We were touring in Japan. And he did the orchestrated track to Sloop John B. We came back in from Japan and did the harmonies and the leads and everything like that. And I ended up on the Pet Sounds album. So there's all different ways it could happen. All different ways.
I heard the, you know, everyone in the band seemed to be quite excited, quite interested in Pet Sounds as the project was forming. Was Capitol as supportive of the band of Pet Sounds? Was anyone from the label, were they worried that it was such a unique sounding album for the time?
Well, you pinned it because they played the album. Our A&R guy was nicest guy in the world, Carl Ingeman. He was our A&R guy at Capitol Records. He went on to manage the Osmonds and Donny and Marie and as well as the Osmond group. But they played, the Capitol Records played it for their marketing team, and Carl Ingeman came back and said, and Brian and I presented the album to Capitol, and Carl said, gee guys, this is great, but could you do something more like California Girls or I Get Around or Fun or Don't Worry Baby or something. In other words, they wanted that hit 45 formula to continue on ad infinitum. But we were interested in breaking boundaries, experimenting, and getting a little complex in the orchestration. We used a lot of instrumentation. And because so there were effectively two groups as of the time when Brian left the tour and went into the studio. From 65 on for a while, there were two groups. The touring group, which was Carl, Mike, Dennis, Al, and Bruce from 65 on. And a little later on, Blondie and Ricky from South Africa joined us for Sail on Sailor and a couple other things. But there were two groups. So the touring group was often Japan while Brian was in the studio with some of the greatest musicians in West Coast called the Wrecking Crew, right? And so he had the tracks done and we came back from Japan. We labored over doing the harmonies and all the backgrounds and the leads for for the Pet Sounds album. We must have done, wouldn't it be nice, we must have done 25 takes of certain sections of it just to make sure it was perfect. And there is a box set that just solos just the vocals on Pet Sounds, and it's pretty amazing to listen to.
I love that. Yeah, Pet Sounds vocals only. That is amazing. And I always wondered, like, I mean, with all the recording and the trial and error that I'm sure the band had to go through in getting the harmonies right, I mean, it must have been 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours, even longer sometimes, of just continual singing. How did you maintain the voices that long?
Well, it wasn't always pleasant or easy, but we were looking for the perfect blend, the perfect harmony, the perfect vibration together. And so, if one person sang just a little bit off on a four-part thing, they're behind or ahead of something, or flat or sharp or whatever it might be, just a tad, just a little bit, most people wouldn't pick up on it or care. But Brian was, I call him the Stalin of the studio, because he wanted it perfect, and he was looking for something that normal human beings don't hear. But it paid off in the fact that those harmonies are perfect. They really are. What was committed to the LP of Pet Sounds, the vocals were perfect.
I understand. Correct me if this story is wrong. During the recording of Pet Sounds, because of Brian's perfectionism, I think you gave him, playfully, of course, the nickname Dog Ears, because he could hear things that others don't.
I sure did. That is the truth.
Oh, great. And that actually helped morph the title of the album, Pet Sounds, because Dog Ears, Pet Sounds, that kind of was the bridge.
No, that wasn't the connection there. I did say that, Dog Ears, because dogs are known to hear things that human beings can't, in ranges that they're capable of hearing. But no, the reason why I called it Pet Sounds is, first of all, it's a double entendre, means two things. It's our favorite sounds, or it's literally Pet Sounds. And at the end of the record, there's a train going by, but there's two of Brian's dogs at the time, Banana and Louie, were barking. So we recorded the dogs barking and added that to the record along with the train going by. And that was why I said, well, let's call it Pet Sounds. He didn't know what to call it before I said that. Then he liked it, you know.
I remember, I think the original title for the album, the working title, was Our Freaky Friends. Is that right? Were there other alternate titles? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And with Brian's hearing and his attention to that sort of detail, when the records were pressed, because in the process of making records, there's test pressings, right? And they were shared with the band.
Yeah.
Did everyone get the test pressings? Was there a lot of sending them back for corrections? Do you recall?
No. It wasn't necessary, because many of the pressings were just the tracks, and sometimes tracks and backgrounds. And I would take those tracks, and in several situations, I would sit with the record and really get into the feeling, the mood, and the tempo, and the concept of the record, and write lyrics accordingly. Alliteration was a part of the that process, and Chuck Berry influenced me in the alliterative part. So when he said something like, when I got on the city bus and found me a vacant seat, I thought I saw my future bride walking down the street. I shouted to the driver, "Hey, conductor, you must slow down. I think I see you. Please let me off this bus." So it was a staccato, alliterative kind of thing. So I would come up, "Well, she got her daddy's car and she cruised through the hamburger stand now. Seems she forgot all about the library like she told her old man now. And with the radio blasting, goes cruising just as fast as she can now. And she'll have fun, fun, fun till her daddy takes a T-bird away." By the way, fun, fun, fun is in the new Barbie billion, jillion selling movie. And Margot Robbie said she was born in 1990 in Australia, by the way. Mm-hmm. And she said she never listened to the Beach Boys. She was obsessed. I mean, never listened to the Beatles. She was obsessed with the Beach Boys, which I think that's pretty nice for a beautiful young lady who is a star of the most successful movie of the year, and maybe many years too.
Well, I think she's from Queensland, and they are known for just gorgeous beaches up there. So I'm sure there's plenty of Beach Boys inspired music around that area.
They sure are, and we've been there, and we played there, and we and there are some beautiful beaches and not bad looking women either.
I tell you, that's the reason I came here. So you talked about, I guess, the acetates, the test records that you made out of the studio that you created lyrics from. Do you still have those? Do you still have the sort of acetate, a box of test pressings and things like that in the Mike Love archive?
I have some buried. I have a few buried in deep in the vault, which I don't have. But, you know, I have a couple of things like that. But the main story there is Bruce took an acetate of, Pet Sounds to England, and Keith Moon introduced Bruce to John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And they listened to Pet Sounds album a couple of times one evening. And so, So that was a very handy use of the acetate. Bet Sounds had just yet to have an album cover. It had yet to been pressed up, but the acetate contained the entire album, and the those two Beatle guys were the first among the first people to hear that outside of the Beach Boys, scene.
In the late 60s, early 70s, they started clamping down on a lot of the test pressings, or acetates, I should say, because they started feeding the bootleg market. Were the Beach Boys heavily bootlegged?
Oh, hell yes. There's all kinds of bootlegs of Beach Boys stuff. And there's stuff that we never released that's been bootlegged. There's album cuts that we didn't come out with or never made it to the light of day. They're available in bootleg. Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, people stealing tapes out of the studio and what. Do you know if there's any missing master tapes of the Beach Boys?
I wouldn't know. I don't. I'm not up to date on any of that kind of thing, the forensic stuff. There's a guy named Alan Boyd who's our archivist. And they've worked on compilation albums recently, like Feel Flows and Ceylon Sailor, and really nice compilations that have been really great of a combination of two or three records. And there's even been some vinyl created for that, but also, some CDs and packages and stuff. And so, Mike Love, I'm on the phone with our management and our agency planning our future shows all the time, live music. And I want to do a live album of what we're doing recently. And that'll ought to be awesome because we're doing some pretty interesting stuff.
Oh, maybe live from Stagecoach.
If they would let us, some places are very particular about what they allow to be done or recorded. Yeah. But that is a good idea. And, thank you for mentioning that. I'm going to see if it's possible.
All right. Do I get a producer credit?
If you like. Suggested by.
I'm happy to take a free copy of producer the record. That's credit, fine. Yeah. and the reason I ask about the master tapes, because I know, and Alan Boyd, is an archivist, I believe, recently or in the past 10 years unearthed some of the missing master tapes. So I think Shut Down Volume 2.
And that's
two.
Mark Lynette. And Mark Lynette is the recording engineer who's done so many remasterings of Beach Boys songs. And Alan Boyd, those two guys worked together on those things. And they normally consult with us about, or with me about, running order and stuff like that. Because I did the running order for Sounds of Summer. I'm just interested in making the listener experience of an LP not too dissimilar from going to a concert, you know, with the opening of it and then the middle and then the end of it. Not, you know, the tempos and the concepts and the lyrics and everything, try to make them complement each other. In other words, if you'd got 409, you wouldn't maybe do God Only Knows right either before or after it, but you might do In My Room into God Only Knows, right? Mm-hmm. So it would set it up beautifully.
Yeah, there's an art so to that, kind of crafting that playlist. Yeah. Mike, I know we're, you know, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much. I just one question before we start to wrap up, and this has to do with vinyl records. Now, there's a lot of Beach Boys records out there, as we know, a lot of very collectible ones. Do you know what the most valuable Beach Boys record is?
And which one was the most valuable?
Yeah. Any idea? Which one?
Is that what you're today, asking?
Yeah, today, that goes for collectibles.
I wouldn't know, except that I think Pet Sounds would have to be it, but I don't know for sure because I didn't analyze it that way. There's there's compilation albums like Sounds of Summer sold maybe by now like 4 or 5 million. That's pretty good. And Endless Summer sold, it was called 20 Golden Greats in London, and it sold 1 million in just Great Britain. Mm-hmm. So, and about, I think, 3 million in the U.S. I mean, numbers may or may not be.
So just to clarify, for collectors, it has to do with its rarity and,
you know, I mean, they're LPs. And, you know, there's the photographs were taken at, for the album were taken at the San Diego Petting Zoo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Paul McCartney in India said, Mike, you really ought to take care of your album. And here's this, take more care with your album covers. He literally said that one night we were talking on the roof of the place we were staying. And I was thinking, wow, here's the master of Sergeant Pepper's, the genius of the Beatles, telling me that we ought to take more care with our album covers. I said, Paul, you're absolutely right. We've always been more concerned with what went on the vinyl inside the cover. See? Touche, kind of. You know, and it's true. We really never cared that much about album covers, and we let Capitol Records do it. And, I mean, you know, and here's, you know, the Beatles took far more care and stuff like that. Particularly, yeah. John, particularly Paul, who was totally into Apple Records and everything like that.
Suffice to say, it's worked out well for everyone.
yeah.
So what I was going to say is the most collectible Beach Boys record right now on this in the collectible market is Summer in Paradise. One vinyl pressing of that record was done in Asia. On its release, and copies currently go for between $1,500 and $2,000.
Wow. Well, I wrote Summer in Paradise with Terry Melcher, produced it. Mm-hmm. And I love this message of that song. So, I would like to reissue that one for sure. I think it's thematic, and it's somewhat important. You know, in 1972, we did a single called Don't Go Near the Water. And we did the video on the Brighton Beach in England. And that was a song. It was about the environment, particularly the ocean. Don't go near the water. Don't you think it's sad what's happening to the water? The water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. The poison, the toxins floating out to sea now threatens life on land. Don't go near the water to do it any harm. Do it any wrong. Don't go near the water. It's the message of our song. So, and then Summer in Paradise is way back when. Well, their master plan was having fun, fun, fun as America's band. We came out rocking with Rhonda and Barbara and singing a surf and sand. Now, as we look at, back over all the fun we had, if our lifestyle's over it now, it sure is sad. We got to get back to living without a care, bringing sunshine, water, and an ozone layer. Paradise is a state of mind where Mother Nature nurtures and man is kind. Wouldn't it be nice if we could bring back summer in paradise? So I want to open with that song and then go right into Serpent Safari. You know?
Yeah. well, Mike, thank you so much for sharing that with us and sharing those memories and being patient with my record nerd questions here and giving us a peek into the amazing life and career. I want to make sure people are aware Beach Boys are playing at Stagecoach Festival, April 26th through 28th, 2024. Stagecoachfestival.com. It's in Southern California. It's kind of like the Coachella of country music. And of course, seeing the Beach Boys in Southern California, I mean, that just, you know, that's a no-brainer. I'll put the ticket links in this episode page. And Mr. Mike Love, thank you so much for joining us here on the Vinyl Guide. And again, looking forward to hopefully either being at Stagecoach and or seeing you guys next time you're down under.
Oh, I hope to be down under pretty soon. When I say pretty soon, during the summer, which is our winter up in the north, we had 700 inches of snow at my home in Lake Tahoe this past season. So I'm very interested in going down under in the December, January period. And we'll see if that can happen.
And it, as you know, all the women here look like Margot Robbie. So, yeah,
oh, sure they did. No, I've been there enough times to know that's not quite accurate.
All right. Thanks again, Mike.
All right.
Oh, man, he's pretty funny. I like talking to Mike. He's a pretty good dude. And hey, don't forget there's an extended version of this interview available only to show patrons, patreon.com/vinylguide. Head up there now, help support the show, and we would be ever so grateful. And enjoy all the extras. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on social media. Put them on Facebook, tweet them out on Twitter, share them on Reddit forums and Facebook groups. Even send links over to your friends. Show them how to get a podcast on that smartphone of theirs. They'll be thankful, and of course, so will I. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.